Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Trump administration's proposed revisions of the Endangered Species Act, which was passed by Congress in 1973 and signed into law by President Nixon. A world leader in the study of present-day extinctions and what can be done to prevent them, Stuart Pym, a professor of conservation ecology at Duke University, who has testified to both the House and Senate on the reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act, joins us. We'll discuss the orchestrated campaign underway to kill the Endangered Species Act, led by global warming denier Senator James Imhoff and Wyoming's John Barrasso, who chairs the Senate Environment Committee, in league with oil industry lobbyists and the Interior Department. We will assess this rushed effort by Republicans to push a bill through and get it signed by Trump before the November elections in case the Democrats gain control of either the House or Senate or both and they lose this window of opportunity. And we'll explore industry's arguments rejecting science while citing an economic burden and what can be done to save the Endangered Species Act, which has saved from extinction, among others, the American alligator, the gray whale, and the iconic emblem of the United States, the bald eagle. Then we'll speak with Ryan Cooper, a national correspondent at The Week, where he has an article, Why the Left Needs to Wise Up to the Growing Trump-Russia Scandal. He joins us to discuss the latest bone tossed to the press as the daily distraction, Trump's claim he is very concerned that Russia will meddle in the 2018 midterm elections, but this time he asserts, without offering any evidence, that Moscow, quote, will be pushing very hard for the Democrats. With a constant stream of lies flowing from Trump to Fox News and vice versa, as conspiracy and confusion is sown by the odious Alex Jones on the right and the fruitcake Louise Mensch on the left, little wonder the public has tuned out the Russiagate scandal. Then finally, we will look into the role of the new White House Communications Director, Bill Shine, who came from Fox News, where he was fired for covering up endemic sexual abuse at Trump's favorite network. Scott Horton, a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss how Shine has streamlined the echo chamber loop back and forth between the White House and Fox News. First, Tucker Carlson floats a call to strip the clearances of former top intelligence officials critical of Trump. Then Senator Rand Paul shows up at the White House to lobby for it. Then a Fox News plant at the White House press briefing asks Sarah Sanders a softball question. And then she parrots her prepared statement naming six former top intel officials, thus closing the loop. And joining us now is Stuart Pym, a professor of conservation ecology at Duke University, a world leader in the study of present-day extinctions and what can be done to prevent them. His commitment to science and policy has led to his testimony to both House and Senate committees on the reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stuart Pym.
Well, thank you so much.
And rather than reauthorize the Endangered Species Act, which was passed in 1973 and signed into law by President Nixon, it seems that the Republicans are determined in this window before the November election to try and gut it. But they're using this ploy, as Rob Bishop, the Republican of Utah and chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, says in his statement, now is the time to modernize this antiquated law to simultaneously benefit both endangered species and the American people. So it seems like they're saying, well, we've got to modernize it by gutting it as opposed to improving it. So it seems to me that this is the big lie.
Oh, it's absolutely preposterous. Even by the standards of this very anti-scientific administration that we now have, this is sort of really pathetic. The act has been extraordinarily successful once a species gets put on the Endangered Species Act. Then it's got a 99.9% chance of surviving. And, you know, the evidence for that is all around us. You know, off the coast of California, you have gray whales. In 49 of the 49 continental United States, we have our national bird, bald eagles. It's been a very, very successful act indeed. And what particularly angers me is the venality of the arguments that this act is, you know, somehow against economic activity. I mean, there are many reasons why people come to California, but one of the reasons I come to California is so I can watch gray whales. There is, you know, a new whaling industry, and that whaling industry is people go out with their cameras off your coast, and they watch whales. People watch bald eagles all over the place. It gives them a great deal of joy. I'm in New York, where there are peregrine falcons nesting in New York City. And in fact, the wildlife is a business that brings in a huge amount of money to local communities, often rural communities. Why do you go to Utah? You do not go to Utah to appreciate a uranium mine. You go to Utah to appreciate its scenery and its wildlife. You go to Wyoming to appreciate grizzly bears and wolves. And I understand that those things are in the way of a small group of people who want to make money after money by raping and pillaging the environment. But the reality is that those activities bring in a lot of money to local communities.
So if they're about to kill the golden goose at the behest of oil companies and the extraction industries like timber and mining, obviously, given that a Republican President Richard Nixon signed the Endangered Species Act into law in 1973, and now they're claiming it's out of date and it needs modernizing, but in modernizing it, they're going to gut it as opposed to improve it. And that seems to be the tactic. But it wouldn't be working, I don't think, unless there'd been a decade-long campaign on the part of the Republicans to create a kind of anti-science constituency in this country. And that, I think, is the toughest part of all, isn't it? We've got so many Americans who don't believe in science, believe in creationism over evolution, et cetera, et cetera. It's a shocking phenomenon, but a very daunting one.
I agree. I mean, as a scientist at a university, I'm very lucky. I'm surrounded by people who and students who are scientifically well educated. But it deeply worries me as an American that we are harming science and technology, and we're sending an unmistakable message that we don't care about science. When President Obama left office, the head of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, John Holdren, an outstanding American scientist, he left as well as all of his staff. And since that time, the White House has not had what we would probably call a White House science advisor. We have become a very hostile place for scientific activities. We have politicians who deny global warming, the evidence of which is patently obvious to almost everybody. And this does not do us any good. It does not do us any good in terms of our international competitiveness and issues like endangered species, getting back to the message. It basically misses the point that 300 million Americans visit national parks each year. That's essentially every American visits a national park. And that brings in a lot of money, a lot of resources. Endangered species are species which people enjoy. And that's part of the economies of a lot of places. This is a remarkably stupid, venal, and very, very narrow-minded set of actions.
And you mentioned global warming denial. Of course, the person who's shepherding this effort to gut the Endangered Species Act through the Senate is Senator James Imhoff, because Senator McCain, who would normally oppose gutting it, has terminal cancer. And of course, along with Imhoff, you have Wyoming's John Barrasso, who chairs the Senate Environment Committee. And, of course, the gray wolf that's come back into Wyoming will now be endangered again. It's hard to believe. I mean, Wyoming's in a beautiful state, and it's amazing to visit. And the idea that the senator from Wyoming is leading this, but you have to go back to Trump's cavalier, callous disregard for everything pretty much that most Americans treasure because he's just destroying stuff right, left and center. But he delegated his son, Donald Trump Jr., who's famous for shooting leopards and giraffes and elephants in Africa, he delegated him to choose the Interior Secretary. So needless to say, Don Jr. found Ryan Zinke, a fellow big game hunter who loves to shoot things.
Well, you know, I have sympathies for, you know, for the hunt, for responsible hunters and fishermen, because they often care very much about the environment. I don't hunt, but I have plenty of friends who do. And, you know, I'm sympathetic for people who want to go and hunt white-tailed deer in the East, for example, and do so in a responsible way. Why on earth anybody would want to kill a giraffe? I have no idea whatsoever. I think it's wrong to portray this as being a battle between environmentalists and hunters. Many hunters are people who care about the environment. But if you're a hunter, why do you need to kill a grizzly bear? A grizzly bear is a magnificent animal. I don't see that you are necessarily proving your manhood by shooting it with a high-powered rifle. And that grizzly bear is certainly worth a lot more as a grizzly bear than it is as a skin in one's den. I think what's happening is a small, vocal, very well-connected group of people are trying to impose some very bizarre views on the vast majority of Americans who enjoy nature, who enjoy wildlife, who enjoy the Endangered Species, that the Endangered Species Act has protected. And I think that's an incredible tragedy.
Well, I'll curtail my thoughts on these wannabe Ernest Hemingways and the notion that the bigger your gun, the smaller your penis. I find it pretty horrible that you have to somehow enhance your manhood by killing majestic animals. But let's turn to the central argument here between science and commerce, because this, the Commerce Department's also playing a role along with the Interior Department in gutting the Endangered Species Act. They're citing an economic burden, but they can't give you a precise cost-benefit. And that's ridiculous to pit nature against commerce, and particularly when you
–
go ahead.
I haven't seen the details of these various bills. I think there are three of them out there, right. And I haven't read them in any great detail. But I have in the past read some of the bills. I've testified to House and Senate committees four or five times over the last decade or two. And one of the things that was interesting in previous attempts was that they were very anxious to point out the cost of endangered species. And they were completely reluctant to ever, you know, work out the benefits of endangered species. And I thought that was really curious. I mean, you know, if you want to do a cost-benefit analysis, then bring it on. Let's bring into this debate the, you know, the tens, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars that we Americans spend on enjoying wildlife and going to our national parks and staying in the hotels in the national parks, and bird watching, and driving around in off the road vehicles and fly fishing and, you know, all the other things that we do to enjoy nature. Let's bring that into the argument. I understand a rancher who loses livestock to wolves at the edge of Yellowstone. That's a real problem, and I sympathize with the rancher and his or her economic losses. But let's also realize that, you know, a lot of people, I mean, millions of people go to Yellowstone, and what do they want to see? They want to see wolves, and they want to see grizzly bears, and they want to see, you know, bison and elk. Let's bring those benefits into the calculation. So I have nothing against the economic costs. I should say, I think that's not the only reason. I think there are powerful religious, spiritual reasons to conserve our environment. I'm not a Catholic, but I was at the Vatican last year advising the Pope's Academy of Sciences. And, of course, the Pope came out a couple of years ago with a very powerful statement about the importance of protecting our natural world as, you know, as a theological political argument. So, yes, it's a matter of economics, but it's also a matter of ethics. And I'm afraid those arguments are getting drowned out in these really spurious and badly informed arguments about the fact that endangered species protection hurts people. It does hurt some people, but it benefits far more.
But isn't there something incredibly phony about the arguments about, from the point of view of the Republicans trying to push this through in terms of how Endangered Species Act hurts commerce? And the examples are, for example, oil companies, they want to drill on areas where there is the sage grouse, and they want to get rid of protection of the sage grouse, and also the American burying beetle. So the argument is that who cares about some little insect? You know, let's drill, baby, drill. But it's predicated upon the idea that somehow that piece of land is hurting the profits of a company that can drill somewhere else. I mean, what is the compulsion to drill in the Arctic Wildlife Reserve? What is the compulsion to drill in areas where the sage grouse lives? Or what is the compulsion of a developer who wants to build a bunch of condominiums in some protected wetlands? Can't he build those condominiums somewhere else? And how can you then charge, in effect, profits that you would have made from something that you can't build and say that is to my detriment because of the Endangered Species Act?
Absolutely. I mean, let's take some of those examples. I mean, the Arctic Wildlife Refuge is a place of spectacular beauty and extraordinary wildlife. You know, so the issue is, should we drill there? Should we destroy that area? If we destroy it and its wildlife, you know, that's it. We are never going to get it back to the way it was. The reality is very, very clear that fossil fuels are not going to be the fuels of the future. They may be today's fuels. They may be certainly yesterday's fuels, but they're not going to be the fuels of tomorrow. We're putting billions of tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year. It's causing an enormous amount of harm to people. It's causing an enormous amount of economic harm. We've got to move away from fossil fuels. So the reality is, let's put that effort into working on renewables, working on efficiencies, being more clever in how we use our natural resources. Many of these sort of funny, peculiar, odd-named species are living in places that are really special. I mean, in California, you've got the California spotted owl. Well, the spotted owls have become a sort of a poster child of endangered species. The brief history of spotted owls in the West is that the Forest Service didn't allow extensive logging on old-growth forests until after the Second World War, and within about 50 years, 90% of those forests had gone, and it was the Endangered Species Act that protected those forests that remained. It said, no more, chop any more forests down, we're going to lose those forests. Now, you know, do the people of California want to see all their old-growth forests, you know, converted into wood chips? And I suspect when you put it like that, the answer is no. Now, that's a tough choice for people who are living in the communities who have depended on logging. But it was clear, I think, to many of them that logging, you know, if you log 90% of the forest in 50 years, you don't need to be much of a mathematician to figure out you're not going to have much forest left in another decade or two. You've got to find an alternative way. So many of these stories are about being smart, of doing things in sensible ways, of getting around the table, working out solutions that work for everybody. And if that means, you know, not draining the wetland, putting the condominium somewhere else, then so be it.
Well, Stuart Pym, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me on your program.
Well, thank you, Stuart. And again, I've been speaking with Stuart Pym, who's a professor of conservation ecology at Duke University, a world leader in the study of present-day extinctions and what can be done to prevent them. His commitment to science and policy has led to his testimony to both House and Senate committees on the reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act. We can take a brief station break. We're back discussing the latest bone tossed to the press as the daily distraction by Donald Trump, who claims that this time Moscow will meddle in our elections on behalf of the Democrats.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand. No, just won't understand these things. Thank you for your message, but I don't understand. No, just won't understand.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ryan Cooper, a national correspondent at The Week, whose work has appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. And he has an article at The Week, Why the Left Needs to Wise Up to the Growing Trump-Russia Scandal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Cooper.
Thanks for having me.
And Ryan, before we get into your article today, the latest bone tossed by Trump to the press as the daily distraction is Trump's claim that he's very concerned that Russia will meddle in the 2018 midterm elections. But this time, he asserts without offering any evidence that Moscow, quote, will be pushing very hard for the Democrats. So that's a bit of a howler, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is pretty classic Trump projection, I think. You know, it's just like, accuse your enemies of doing the things that you yourself are doing. It couldn't be more ridiculous.
But with a constant stream of lies flowing from Trump to Fox News and vice versa, and conspiracy confusion being sown by the odious Alex Jones on the right and the fruitcake, as you call her, Louise Mensch on the left, surely it's little wonder that the public is tuned out of this so-called Russiagate scandal.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say people have necessarily tuned it out, you know. There's some polls on whether people think it's an important issue, which usually get up to in the like 40 to 50% range. You turn on, you know, late night comedians are talking about it all the time. It just gets a ton of media coverage. I think almost like that is almost kind of leveraged it into the public consciousness. I think it is. You know, in my article, I compared it to Watergate, in that Watergate took many, many months to sort of percolate into the public consciousness because it was very confusing. You know, this big, complicated story, like these people are somehow maybe sort of associated with the president, maybe, and what are they doing, and why are they over there, and what's the connection? And, you know, eventually, you know, it got to like a narrative that's connected to Nixon, you know, with the tapes and the missing bid, and, you know, and that's where people's like minds could focus on it. So I think it will be only become more so as time passes.
Well, Watergate, what the break-in happened on June 1972, and by mid-1973, it was starting to gain traction, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the investigators had uncovered some stuff. The Woodward and Bernstein, you know, were picking up threads, and they were, especially towards the beginning, they were just right, like doing these little stories that made, you know, no sense to someone who wasn't following the every little twist and turn. But then later, you know, other people like picked up all that stuff and like sort of digested it into a comprehensible narrative. Yeah, so.
And of course, you know, the bottom line, Ryan, that I forgot to mention is in the interim between the Watergate break-in and when it started to get some traction in the press via the Washington Post, Richard Nixon got reelected by almost a record majority, did he not?
Yeah, there was a poll right in August. I mean, like, is this Watergate thing going to change your vote? And 68% of people said no. Yeah, and he won a gigantic landslide. You know, one of the all-time biggest victories in American history, because, you know, it just hadn't quite come through yet. People figure it out. It's some small thing. It doesn't really matter.
So back to the sort of daily distraction. It's obvious to me that President Trump is trying to stay one step ahead of the sheriff and is basically all he knows is reality TV. And we have the phenomenon of government by stunt. When do you think the act is going to get stale?
In terms of my suspicion, which is really not grounded on all that much, to be honest, my sense of that is that his performance does really well at locking down his base. Trump is very popular among Republicans, and he's popular among, like, maybe a third of independents. And that gets him to about 35-40%. And whether that's going to work, like, in terms of shoring him up politically, I think will depend on whether something really clear and damning comes out of the Mueller investigation or from somewhere else, and whether the Democrats can present a compelling alternative picture. And probably even more importantly, whether the economy continues to kind of, you know, bumble along in a pretty good position. Trump's tariffs are wreaking havoc to certain numbers of people, and the tax cut, you know, just got immediately digested by the rich. But, you know, unemployment is really low. People are generally doing, like, much better than they were, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, certainly. And that, I think, is buoying him up considerably. And if the bottom falls out of that, there's another financial crisis or something, I think it's going to be the end of him.
So if the Trump-Russia thing, if Mueller doesn't get his report out until after the election, and maybe there'll be some more shoes to drop before then, what's your sense of then how this Trump-Russia scandal should play? You have this peculiar sort of reversal in American political history, if you will. You know, the red baiters and the Soviet haters on the Republican side are now making excuses for Putin and being in denial about any possible collusion. Then people on the left who normally hate and at least were very suspicious of the CIA now hoping somehow that the deep state nails Trump. And then, of course, you've got the phenomenon that you write about on the left as well that are equally in denial, the, you know, Oliver Stones and the editors of The Nation, et cetera. So given that landscape, what kind of traction do you think the so-called Russiagate scandal will have?
Well, again, I'd say, you know, it's going to depend. What details come out is going to be very important in terms of the way it's digested. But I think that there's some, you know, liberals kind of trying to whip up a, like, almost, you know, a kind of national security panic. And it's really not working very well because that kind of thinking doesn't fit into liberal mind, you know, worldviews very much. If the tables were turned and this was a Democrat, this were Hillary Clinton, who had somehow, been the beneficiary of Russian electoral espionage, you can bet the right will work themselves into an absolute lather over this. But I think there's an alternative perspective that's really only just beginning to kind of, like, consolidate. And that's to say that the Russiagate story is not really about national security in the way that people tend to think about it. It's more about corruption in sort of loose international alliance of ethno-nationalism and plutocracy, and the fact that the, you know, Republican Party is so corrupt that they are eager and willing to benefit from the meddling of a hostile foreign power. You know, I mean, literally they infiltrated the NRA, allegedly, you know, and bribed them to turn in a more Russia direction. And they just flopped over. You know, they just have no dedication to the United States as laid out in its sort of founding documents and constitution.
Sure. Well, there may have also Russian money may have been laundered through the NRA to benefit Trump. And you would think the fact that these criminal kleptocrats and oligarchs in Russia, who were clearly a conduit for both campaign money and also for investments in Trump's real estate empire, and the fact that the other players in this 2016 election that aren't getting the attention that Russia's getting, and that is the Emirates and Saudi Arabia, they also clearly favored Trump and wanted him and hated Obama and, by extension, Hillary Clinton. So
yeah,
that shoe hasn't dropped yet either, has it? I mean, in other words, you think that the Bernie Sanders side of the political left in this country would recognize that this is about income inequality. Do you want America to be run by the same kind of oligarchs that run Russia and the same kind of despots that run Saudi Arabia and the Emirates?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of phrasing it. You know, you don't need to stoke the national security panic. And I always emphasize that even though Putin is a very sinister figure, who really is, he did the same thing to a much greater degree in Hungary, in the Czech Republic. Israel is jumping on there because they're all on with the right-wing nationalist agenda. And it would be very unwise to view this as a problem you can solve with some sort of like belligerent chest thumping. You know, this, you know, you have to be diplomatic with Russia. You know, it's a nuclear superpower, and you know, they have been fairly poorly treated in some ways over the last 10 years. So, you know, there's no solution to this that involves military confrontation. What we need to do is clamp down on the plutocracy in the United States, you know, taxation, and start looking at cross-border capital flows. A lot of that stuff is illegal. Like, a ton of real estate in Miami and New York City is probably money laundering. You know, just this termitic infestation of plutocratic money, and it's all over the place in most countries. And that's the problem. And yeah, and as I said, you know, Bernie Sanders is kind of starting to make this pitch too, to just say, like, I think he had a tweet the other day, like, yeah, this, after the Helsinki summit, it was something like, this is a great day for Russia and plutocrats in both countries, but it's a bad day for the American people. And I think it's important for the left to have, like, a good answer on this. And I think, in fact, it's a very convincing answer. It's about how this toxic interaction of corrupt political parties, plutocracy, and right-wing ethno-nationalism. And it's just not what I think most people really want. Trump's base is on board, but Trump is very unpopular.
But so far, there's an ironic confluence of Trump's narrative. His best excuse for this meeting with Putin that made no sense and was done in secret, and afterwards it was so apparent at the press conference that Putin owns this guy and that we have an incredibly weak and ignorant and almost pathetic leader. But the Trump's best excuse is Putin's got nuclear weapons, and that's exactly the same excuse that was given in the letter that the Nation people put together of Van der Heuvel and her husband, which a bunch of prominent liberals signed. At the end of the day, they basically said, we basically have to forgive Putin for who he is because he's got nuclear weapons. Well, you know, that's, I mean, the fact that...
Right. So that's true. So, yeah, Russia does have nuclear weapons. You must have diplomatic contact with Russia, and you have to, you know, negotiate, you know, given the fact that they have a pretty, you know, formidable cyber espionage apparatus, apparently. And, you know, it was kind of interesting to see what the branding that Trump and Putin are trying to put on this thing, to be like, oh, who knows what they talked about. I'm sure it wasn't what they actually said in the press conference, but it was like nuclear nonproliferation and like negotiating an end to the war in Syria and stuff that is more or less unobjectionable. The problem is when, you know, Trump is thrashing around in NATO and alienating all of our EU allies and just damaging the United States internationally by acting like such a buffoon, maybe on the orders of Putin, who knows, or for whatever reason, you know, that's the part of it that's really where Putin is directly benefiting by just sowing all this chaos in the Western alliance. And that's the stuff that I think is very objectionable. Like, if Trump were to negotiate some new START treaty or whatever to reduce the amount of nuclear weapons that both countries have, I think that would, you know, you can't really argue with something like that. I don't think it will happen. But the key thing, I think, to focus on is how we need to patch things up. The United States may never live down electing Trump. You know, I mean, I think that distrust is going to be there for decades at least. The fact that our system can throw up somebody like this. But at the very least, you know, somebody, the next president is going to have to go and say, hey, sorry, guys. We didn't mean to do that.
I'm the cleanup crew. So just in closing then, why do you think it is that on the left in America, I get all this mail all the time from people who obviously just watch RT all the time and have that kind of reflexive anti-Americanism, blame America first, you know, the kind of anger at Uncle Sam. And I don't understand why the American left can't find a kind of political sweet spot in, isn't it possible that you can be an idealist on domestic issues and a realist on foreign policy at the same time? Do you have to be an apologist for America's terrible sins around the world first before recognizing that there's some really bad people out there who really want to destroy this country or at least undermine it and weaken it? And, of course, they looks like they've found their perfect agent.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's important to, you know, I mean, recognize that, yeah, the United States has done many, many horrible things over the years. But, you know, it is its own kind of chauvinism to be like anything bad that happens anywhere is the United States' fault. And you do kind of see that tendency sometimes. I also think that people have a reaction to how, you know, more centrist liberals are pointing to the Russia story as being solely responsible for the loss to Trump. And that is definitely not the case. James Comey probably had more to do with that than Russia did. And the fact that it was so close in the first place is because Hillary Clinton was so unpopular. But I think that, well, and the other thing is that people are really, they're very hesitant about ginning up another, you know, kind of like McCarthyite paranoia about Russian infiltration. And that is a real danger. But I think, as you said, you know, you can hit a sort of sweet spot there to be like, yeah, this is a problem. We need to approach it in the right way. And, you know, we don't need to lose our minds about it. But at the same time, we can't just say that, you know, I've seen people suggest that the only possible response you can have to this idea that Trump may be compromised by Putin, which is, frankly, the most logical explanation that I can see, is that we need to improve election security and make for clean elections. And it's just like, it's just barely responsive to the problem. You know, you've got to have something on that.
Right, and the Republicans...
It really matters.
Right, and then the Republicans have quashed all efforts to appropriate funds to fix up our election system. So Trump's statements today are so absurd in the context of that reality. I thank you for joining us, Ryan Cooper.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ryan Cooper, who's a national correspondent at The Week, whose work has appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. And he has an article at The Week, Why the Left Needs to Wise Up to the Growing Trump-Russia Scandal. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the role of the new White House communications director, Bill Shein, who came from Fox News, where he was fired for covering up endemic sexual abuse at Trump's favorite network. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Scott. And I know you've followed the Mueller inquiry very closely. And one of the problems that we have, I think, is the extent to which we're being manipulated by the Trump administration on a daily basis, being essentially distracted from the Mueller probe. For example, yesterday, Trump tweeted out essentially a threat of nuclear war against Iran. That came out of nowhere and sort of went nowhere. So that, I think, was an example of his efforts to distract us. And then, of course, the release of or the promise or threat to take the clearances away from six senior intelligence officials, the former head of the CIA, the former head of the FBI, the former DNI, the former National Security Advisor, the former head of the NSA, and the former deputy head of the FBI. That, again, looked like another piece of an effort to distract the press, at the same time, of course, feed Trump's base with this delusion that the deep state is out to get him. So do you feel manipulated? I certainly do.
Well, I think this is the mark of entry of Bill Shine. I mean, we know the White House now has a new communications director. Bill Shine is one of the men who made politics at Fox, was the right hand of Rupert Murdoch for years, was forced out in the sex scandals there, and now he's come on board the White House, just started now, and his hallmark was always attack, 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 always be on the attack and on the offensive, never defend. So, you know, he's stepped in a situation in which the White House is facing outrage over the crisis on the border with the incarceration of infants, a disastrous performance by all accounts in Helsinki, as well as Brussels and in the UK. Problems on every front. And, you know, what's his prescription for this situation? Attack, of course.
So it looks very much, though, that the whole thing was kind of cooked up. You got Tucker Carlson sort of floating it. Then you got the White House meeting with Senator Rand Paul, which seemed like a setup. And then a question at the press conference that seemed like a question designed for Sarah Sanders to drop this so-called bombshell, which, of course, makes no sense. You know, the reason that senior intelligence officials have their clearances is that the current heads of these intelligence agencies need to consult with them, because if something crops up relating to the past about which they have no knowledge, they have to turn to these former heads to say, what do you know about X, Y, and Z's? So walk us through the setup, if you will.
Well, I think you've laid it out right there. I mean, I would say in the first instance, it shows just the perfect coordination of these efforts between Fox News and the White House. So this all comes up as a report that Fox News carries. Then it gets picked up by a member of Congress who's close, who plants the question. Then a reporter in the audience raises it, and so on. So this is all sort of reverberation back and forth between Fox and the White House communications team. So it has a distinct sense or aura of being phony from the very beginning. But I think also just the substance of it, when you think about it, taking away the security clearance of these former, you know, senior most civil servants, they're not getting regular briefings of intelligence. And as you point out, the only reason that they retain their security clearances is that their successors may very well have a question to put to them about something that happened on their watch in the past and may want their guidance or discussion of what happened or their views on it. And for that purpose, in order to have the discussion, they need to have the security clearance. So taking it away seems silly. But, you know, the implication that Trump is making is that they're, you know, in the regular stream of things, of intelligence is coming out of the system, and they're not.
Well, Pompeo consulted with Susan Rice. Susan Rice is on the list, have a security clearance. Why doesn't Pompeo speak up?
I would think, frankly, the director of CIA, who, of course, this all starts as an attack on John Brennan,
the current director was pretty much John Brennan's choice as a successor, had a very close rapport with her. Pompeo also has had a good rapport with his predecessors. So I think they understand that this is politics. And it's being done mostly for Trump to feed his audience with some sort of attack on people from the other camp. So the other camp always has to be portrayed as not loyal and politically motivated. So not surprising, we've seen this going on for a long time, but the level of pettiness right now is very, very high.
And, of course, the Judicial Watch were the people that got this FISA warrant document declassified under the Freedom of Information Act, I assume. I get stuff from Judicial Watch all the time, by the way, offers to interview them, and the stuff that they say on a daily basis is completely lunatic. But it makes you realize how well organized the right is in terms of having their talking points and having their people and having their sound bites on a daily basis. But Trump tweets out, "Congratulations to Judicial Watch and Tom Fitton on being successful in getting Carter Page's FISA documents. As usual, they are ridiculously heavily redacted, but confirm with little doubt that the Department of Justice and FBI misled the courts. Witch hunt rigged a scam." Well, needless to say, not one piece of that is true. The opposite was true, isn't it? I mean, my reading of the redacted document reinforces what the FBI has been saying, what the Justice Department has been saying, and makes a total liar out of Devin Nunes, the House Chairman of the Intelligence Committee.
I think that's right. So, I mean, if we go back to the time of the Nunes memo, remember that the Democrats on his committee, Adam Schiff in particular, several others as well, came out immediately and denounced the Nunes memo and focused in on its claim that the entire Carter Page application was based on the work of Chris Steele in the Steele dossier. They said that's not true. They had reviewed it, that they were, you know, actually that figured as one point, but there were a number of others. And then Nunes came back and said, yes, but, you know, the FBI failed to disclose to the courts that Chris Steele was working as in a commercial contract for an agency that had been hired by the DNC. Schiff, of course, said that was a lie. And now we see the application and we see that spread out over an entire page is a very detailed disclosure of who Chris Steele is, what his background is, how he'd worked with him in the past, and the very specific facts that he was working on retainer for a business intelligence organization that had been hired and was being paid by Party X for Candidate Y. Of course, this is because they reduced the names of American citizens in this. But, of course, anybody reading it would know that that was the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton. So, of course, they fully disclosed everything that was necessary here. And, of course, remember also, we have four different judges at various points hearing these applications, which are coming up over and over again and being renewed many times. These judges are all, every single one of them, all of them, Republican-appointed judges.
Well, if you go back a bit, it's pretty clear that Carter Page was at least the Russians attempted to recruit him. And the FBI had these two Russian intelligence officers under surveillance along with Carter Page. So if the guy's caught being recruited by the Russians, little wonder that they want to keep renewing the FISA applications to find out who he's talking to and how far along the recruitment process it is. And now we've subsequently gotten the transcripts of some of the conversations that the Russian handlers had, the intelligence guys, talking about Carter Page. They talked about him rather derisively. They thought he was greedy and somewhat stupid, but that didn't say they didn't think that he was worth recruiting. So, you know, this is what's extraordinary, is that when you think about Trump's tweet saying it all proves his point and it proves Devin Nunes, when it proves the opposite, it's sort of what he said today, isn't it? Where he said, we're really going to get tough on the Russians and we're going to prevent them from interfering in our elections. Well, that's another lie, because the House and Senate recently blocked efforts to have funds allocated to improving our electoral system. The Republicans blocked it. I mean, I don't know whether they want the Russians to hack this next election so they'll win like they did the last one, but they certainly are not doing what Trump said he's doing.
Yeah, I think that's all very important. I would go back and apply a but-for test here. So is it the case that but for the Christopher Steele dossier and the allegations in it, there would have been no application to observe Carter Page and intercept his communications? No, absolutely not. So we know, based on this prosecution, successful prosecution that resulted in the conviction in 2012, of two Russian espionage agents, we know that he is the character, the main character in the background of that prosecution. He is the person that the intercepts of those two agents showed that they were attempting to recruit, and recorded that he responded positively to every effort to recruit him. So, I mean, you have that already. And then, of course, we know we have a lot of materials here that are redacted, that are marked out. And what the FBI and Department of Justice had done in releasing this publication is everything that's already in the public sector that was already released and disclosed by Devin Nunes. Now that they have they've left in, so you can read it. But materials not yet disclosed are still blacked out. So one thing you've got to note is, yeah, there are many, many other grounds not yet disclosed that covered or justified this surveillance. And we know that that would have included, you know, information that was provided by an Australian diplomat, for instance, and by another undercover asset concerning the existence of this overall Russian active measures influence campaign. So we know that there were quite a few other sources. And I bet, you know, when this is all unredacted and we're able to read it all, we're probably going to find that there's a great deal of corroboration for the concerns that were raised by Christopher Steele. And by the way, those dossiers are constantly being attacked and derided as all garbage, nonsense. It's not a single passage of the Christopher Steele dossier that has been proven to be false.
And a lot of it's proven to be true. So
a lot of it is, and I think you know, and I think there've been several reports by McClatchy that there is a corroboration that's been provided by the Czech government, by the Czech police, about his meeting in Prague. And of course, that's the one thing that the Trump team trotted out very early on in their efforts to discredit. They said this is definitely wrong. He was definitely never in Prague. You don't hear Michael Cohen making that statement anymore. He's gone completely quiet on what's happened in Prague, and there appears to be a substantial amount of corroboration now for the report about him meeting with a Russian agent in Prague. It was one of the more incendiary allegations in that dossier.
And now it's possible that Michael Cohen is off the reservation. I mean, it just shows you how arrogant and foolish Trump is. He never took care of his fixer, who was so loyal to him. He didn't give him some kind of White House sinecure, which he could have easily done. Instead, he just cut him loose, and the guy's very bitter, and he may well end up being Trump's undoing.
I think, you know, the allegations about payments of hush money to former mistresses of Trump are the least of Trump's concerns. They're minor. I think the larger concerns have to do with what he was doing running around Europe in 2016 and meeting with Russian agents.
And that is in the Steele dossier, these meetings that took place in Prague that the White House and Michael Cohen denied, but then McClatchy found out, in fact, that he had crossed from, I think, was it from Germany, I think, into Czechoslovakia. So that's still a real possibility that Cohen will cooperate on that, even though it's with the a different jurisdiction, right? It's with the Southern Manhattan Southern
District. If he cooperates, it will not simply be on the hush payments to mistresses. It'll be on everything. Mm-hmm. That's the way this process operates.
So what's your sense then of when there'll be some resolution? Because you can see how desperate Trump is. He's always trying to stay one step ahead of the sheriff. he just pulls off these stunts, which is what we started out talking about, how we're being constantly distracted by these stunts like threatening nuclear war with Iran, you know, in a midnight tweet. And that, of course, has the whole that day of press coverage following Trump's little breadcrumbs that he drops. And this goes on a daily basis. But my understanding is that there's a lot of stress on him because he's basically trying to stay one step ahead of the sheriff, trying to cover up the fact that he doesn't know what he's doing. He's a complete amateur and incompetent. And he actually is getting nothing done, which may serve the purposes of Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan because they have a free hand. But this is the least engaged presidency in terms of substance in history, isn't it? It's all flim-flam.
Well, I think let's just go back, first of all, to, you know, what's going on with Mueller and how that's likely to proceed. Mueller will rigorously follow the U.S. Attorney's manual, and that manual requires that in politically affected cases, there be no public activity in the last weeks before an election. And that's usually been interpreted as in an election year, a Labor Day cutoff. So I think he's going to be rushing to do everything he can possibly do between now and Labor Day. I think we're likely to see more indictments. I think he is going to push to be done with the first, let's say, the first of the Manafort trials during that period. So I think we're likely to see quite a bit more activity coming from him. And we know from the indictments that were most recently filed what things are coming. So we know that there's a focus on how the Russians put out the hacked materials, and that will certainly include WikiLeaks' Julian Assange, who may be kicked out of the Ecuadorian embassy any day now. We know that there's been discussions between the Ecuadorians and the Brits. I think if he's out there and if he's within the reach of the Americans, they probably will indict him and seek to have him extradited. But then we also know there are a number of other people associated with the campaign, of whom Roger Stone is the one best known and most discussed, who's likely to be charged as well in connection with this as they try to build a bridge between the Russian intelligence activities and the Trump campaign. So I'm expecting between now and Labor Day, we're going to see quite a few more boots drop on that front.
And I don't believe that Roger Stone was the only interlocutor between the Russians and the Trump campaign.
Well, I think if you look at those documents very closely, it's pretty clear that it's plural, not singular. So
right.
Yes, there are definitely multiple people. And I think there are probably individuals whose names we don't know right now, but Roger Stone is the one name we do know, and that's largely because of his own tendency to braggadocio. Right. He loves to be in the center of things for a while, and then when it draws unwanted attention, he goes quiet.
Well, just in closing, what do you think his connection to the Manhattan Madam is?
She did web work for him, so I think they believe she observed or captured data or information that is useful in their case against him. And what that could be is anyone's guess, but it could well be communications data.
So not playmates and hookers and porn stars. This is
she was multitasking,
right?
Always play up those things, but that would not be of interest to Mueller and his team, nor to any of the other federal investigators.
Well, I was just given her profession or her previous profession. One makes the assumption that it might have something to do with that, but
it'll make for a better movie down the road.
Well, stay tuned, and I thank you for joining us, Scott Horton.
My pleasure.
And again, I'll be speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and is a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.